You're listening to 95.7 FM, KDRT LP, Davis, California.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them blue for me and you.
And that music means it's time for the Davis Garden Show. This is Don Shore.
And this is Lois Richter on a bright, beautiful, sunny summer day.
And the temperature as we record this program on July 13th is 83 degrees, going up to a high today of 90. Night temperature this evening, 55. High temperature the day of the broadcast, July 14th, will be 96 degrees with a night temperature of 54. 96 degrees on Friday, around 100 on Saturday, 99 on Sunday, 98 on Monday, 94 on Tuesday with night temperatures about 56 to 59 degrees throughout that period. Slightly above average temperatures for the time of year. We did have a brief heat wave last weekend where we hit 100 degrees a couple days. Prior to that, and shortly thereafter, we had cooler than average temperatures for several days straight. Extremely good pollination weather for your tomatoes, so I hope your vines are growing vigorously and flowering, able to take advantage of that outstanding cooler temperatures and set some great tomatoes for you to be harvesting in about 8 weeks. KDRT is community radio. That means we're public radio and we rely on contributions from listeners like you to fund our operating costs. If you like what you hear, if you like the idea of community radio, head on over to kdrt.org, that's kdrt.org, and click on the support button. We like to highlight some of the local organizations that do great things for the community. The California Raptor Center, CRC, is an education and research facility on the UC Davis campus dedicated to the rehabilitation of injured and orphaned birds of prey. The museum and permanent collection of living, non-releasable raptors open to the public view on weekdays and on Saturdays. It takes in about 100 to 150 sick, injured, and orphaned raptors every year, successfully returning about 60% of them to the wild. Provide hands-on training in the care and management of birds of prey to those interested in rehabilitation. Offer educational programs to schools, ecological and environmental organizations, and the university community. Authorized by the California Department of Fish and Wildlife, unique facility in the state because of the affiliation with UC Davis School of Veterinary Medicine. Lots of great information on their website, CRC, California Raptor Center, crc.vetmed.ucdavis.edu. Check out the events, the ambassador birds, and all the information they have there where you can do remote access learning about these important birds of prey. All right, our resident bird expert is Lois Richter.
I'm a bird expert?
You are a resident bird expert. You have a bird show, don't you?
Oh, I do, Birding with Lois, but that doesn't mean I'm the expert. It means I like doing television shows. What's your question, Dom?
I had a customer ask me something funny because I always talk about the benefits of having jays and mockingbirds on my property. I have very large numbers of them. I have really encouraged the populations of jays, mockingbirds, and I might as well throw in flickers because I have lots of those on my farm. And they, the first two at least, give me significant levels of pest control. I've seen them doing it. I've watched them going from my mulberry tree to the tomato cages and ducking into the tomato cages and picking up a bug and flying off. I never get large populations of leaf-footed bugs or the other kinds of pests that can become large problems for other people. And they said, well, I've heard you talking about this and how to encourage them. Maybe you should talk more about that. Sure, I'd be happy to. And they said, but don't they eat some of your garden stuff too? Don't they eat some of the tomatoes? Don't they make the holes in the tomatoes? Are they the reason I'm seeing holes in my tomatoes? And so if I'm encouraging them, am I trading one problem for another? So that leads to two questions. One, how do I encourage them? I know, but I think you could give a more accurate scientific explanation. And the second is, do they feed on your garden plants at all? Or is it a problem? So we're talking about scrub jays and mockingbirds.
Scrub jays and mockingbirds. So scrub jays like to eat protein. So they love caterpillars and leaf-footed bugs and that sort of thing. But they're a fairly large bird, so they're not going to go after your aphids. That would be the little tiny birds that would go and eat those little tiny aphids. So do jays do damage to a garden? Well, possibly. I would say they'd be more attracted to the ripe fruit on a tree. So I had my plum tree. The harvesters came over and got 250 pounds of plums off it, but not every single plum fell. And so there's a couple up there. And yeah, the jays are coming now that it's ripe. They're coming in there and they're eating their dessert. So what do you do to encourage them, Don?
Well, what I do know happened inadvertently was that I planted two black mulberries at either end of what was then the vegetable garden. I've moved it to a different part of the property, but they were way far apart, but it turned out to be at either end of the property. This is the black mulberry. It's a seedless type, very important, so it's not reseeding all over the place. It fruits over about an 8 week period. They start ripening in June and they ripen all the way through August. And I can assure you that these birds of both types absolutely love black mulberries. In fact, I go out and pick a bunch of these mulberries when they first start to ripen. Once the birds figure out that they're there, it's no longer pleasant to be picking the mulberries because they make such a mess of the area. You can find some, but it's kind of messy. But that's their starting point for going through the garden is to land. I pointed this out to the customer. They're starting by eating something that I was growing, at least ostensibly for food. And I have seen them move on to my blackberries. Well, your blackberries usually yield enough that that's not a huge issue. I did this year notice one scrub jay routinely going and picking off blueberries. Now, that might make me a little more angry because that's a smaller plant, and I suppose they could take a fair percentage of the crop. And I've had people tell me that that can be a problem. But what I provided them was a small tree at either end in which they could feel safe, feed on mulberries, move from that to nearby shrubbery, move from that onto the tomato cages, which they love. They love to just hop from one tomato cage to another, going into the plants and picking up some of these larger insects that would otherwise be hard for us to deal with, like the leaf-footed bug. There's no insect out there that's going to eat leaf-footed bugs, but apparently these birds do. So I may have nesting sites, it's very likely. I definitely have habitat. I definitely have hiding places for them. Honestly, these are gregarious birds. They're not frightened of me or much of anything else, but they do like to have shrubbery nearby, like every bird appears to like, as you can speak to. And they have places where they can move steadily through the garden and find things to eat on their way out. And I do know, yes, indeed, they can eat some berries. Those have been the one thing that I'm probably sharing with them more than some people might like to do.
So you've described exactly how scrub jays, at least, like to operate, and they are going to look for whatever is ripe or edible. They love protein, let's put it that way. Any bug is fair game, any caterpillar is fair game. Butterflies, yeah, they're no bothered with that, except the orange ones. But they also they have ranges. So one scrub jay or one couple will have an area that they work frequently, and if there's a bunch of something and they're not sure if it's ripe or not, they'll go and test it. So on the plums, you may see one plum that's got a little bite out of it. They were going, well, it looks ripe. I don't know. Is it? Oh, no, that's not ripe. That's sour. And so, yes, occasionally we'll do that. When you come to ripe fruit, then they'll eat it. And so, if you have tomatoes that get a little bit overripe, oh, they will love it.
Over,
But
but
it's not very much. And
are they territorial?
yes,
Yeah. So
very.
you have a small population that's occupying your farm or your garden or whatever. If that one dies or moves on, I assume another one will probably move in. I
Or
have
the babies, will grow up there, and then you'll have more until they turn into teenagers and move out. And by teenagers, I don't mean really teenagers. I mean, at some point they're going to not want to live with mom and dad anymore, or mom and dad are going to go, I ain't feeding you. I'm just not feeding you.
A
And
mockingbird's the
so they'll
same?
go.
That was
Now,
scrub jays. Yeah.
those are scrub jays. Now, mockingbirds have a larger area than scrub jays. Scrub jays, they'll be fine if there's, if they're in your yard and there's another pair of scrub jays nearby and they happen to overlap, they're little squabbles, no problem. But the mockingbirds, they really do have larger areas. But they also are more interested in the berries, like when in the wintertime the Toyon berries come out, you'll see mockingbirds in there and robins, and the scrub jays won't be in there eating them, but these other birds will. And then of course there are birds that come by in giant flocks in the wintertime or the fall, and they maneuver through neighborhoods and cities, and they go to, oh, here's a whole bunch of ripe, what, persimmons? Yeah. And then the whole flock will go in and feed on that tree until they're done, and then they'll move on. But you're talking about two birds that are residential. I think they're more helpful than harmful.
That's been my
And
observation, sure. Yeah.
the other thing you can do to try and be nice to them is put out some water. So we have a bird bath just outside our kitchen window, and we see all the little birds coming in and taking a bath and drinking and whatever. And every once in a while, a scrub jay will land, flap in the water, and then it's totally empty because they're so much huger than the little birds. But anyway, flickers are an interesting one because they're the only woodpecker that I know of that is also eating grubs on the ground. So they have a different shape than regular, and than the other woodpeckers we might have around, because they don't just stay in the tree. They also go on the ground and look for grubs and worms and things like that.
That's entirely beneficial as far as that goes.
Oh yeah, and they are not resident. The flickers don't stay here all year. They come in the winter and then they go away for the summer. So
So
they
the
won't be.
mockingbirds, I've observed the mockingbirds seem to move in larger groups than jays. You'll get several of them screaming at each other, or is that them being territorial?
They do not move in groups.
Okay.
I have never seen more than three mockingbirds at one time, and they were having a large discussion
That's
about
what
who should be there.
I would be observing is them having that
Yeah.
discussion.
Now you might
Now the
have
ones you
two
see
that
behind
are a pair,
right.
and then they will tolerate each other
So
usually.
long-term relationship. So the ones that move in large groups, probably the most common that we see in this area, the cedar waxwings, at least I know that much. And on my property, I have some female Chinese pistache trees. Yes, you should see a flock of cedar waxwings go into the Chinese pistache tree with all the red berries. Most people now are planting male Chinese pistache to avoid the litter from the berries. But if you happen to have a female, I guarantee that large numbers of them will move in there. It'll be a dreary day in the winter. You'll walk out there, you'll suddenly realize there's 50 of them in a tree like that, and going to town on the berries. And as we know, they have that feeding habit of just gorging on whatever is there until they can't gorge anymore. And yes, indeed, persimmons, all kinds of things like to eat persimmons. My experience with persimmons personally, and most people I know, you probably couldn't eat the full potential of a mature persimmon tree. Mine is anywhere from 300 to 1,000 fruit in a given year. And I don't know how many persimmons you eat in an average winter, but it's probably not anywhere near that number. So you can share. I let my Fuyu persimmon grow to its full potential. It's a beautiful tree, 30 feet tall, 20 feet across, lovely in the fall with the fall color on the leaves. The fruit, of course, is glorious in the wintertime. And the spring color of the new growth pushing out with that bright chartreuse yellow green color is quite spectacular. They're beautiful trees if you can let them get that big. That's a lot of fruit. It's a lot more than you could possibly eat. And even if you really, really, really like persimmons, and you typically can't pick it very easily, we pick and our neighbors pick whatever they can reach from the stepladder that's under the tree. So that's the bottom quarter of the tree. All the rest of the fruit is gone by January, and it hasn't mostly fallen on the ground except in little pieces because the cedar waxwings, in particular, at least that I recognize, absolutely love them.
Other flocks of birds that might come by are the robins. Now, you don't normally think of robins as being in flocks, but they are in the wintertime here and in going through from tree to tree and Toyon berries and that sort of thing. So
Now
there's another one.
people ask about feeding birds, and usually it's songbirds, so you're putting out seed for them. But we're talking about mockingbirds and jays. They don't go to bird feeders like that. You
Yes,
would
they do.
feed them with what, tabletop type feeders.
Well, they would, jays like big things. Now, understand that the most common food that you will see in a jay's mouth is an acorn. And in fact, Mary Sheet, who was on my Birding with Lois show last week, said that acorns are planted by jays. And if you have oaks and there are no jays in the area, that's not going to be nearly as prolific as if you have jays in oaks. Because what they do is they take an oak, take the little cap off, get the seed, and then they bury it. And then they remember where it is, and then they go back and they dig it up after it's started sprouting. Much easier to see to eat after the shell has cracked
I
open,
see. Okay.
right? And they're very good. If you they've done experiments with watching where the jays have planted the acorns and then come back, and they've even had markers on the jays so they know which jay it was. And yeah, they do. They bury it, they come back. Sometimes they forget.
Oh yes,
And
I
that's
can
when you
attest to
suddenly get, oh, where did that oak
that.
tree come from? Well, that one was planted by a jay.
That's fine if it's in a good
Yeah.
place, let it grow. I will
So if
mention.
you really want if you really want to feed jays, and I have no idea why in the world jays would need to be fed here in Davis. They've got so much food around. But if you wanted to, you would want to put out big nuts, like peanuts in the shell.
Okay.
Drive them crazy.
And
Or those black sunflowers in the shell.
Michelle.
Yeah. Whereas the smaller birds that you're going to be with your feeder, like the white-crowned sparrows, golden-crowned sparrows, juncos, goldfinches. Well, goldfinches have two kinds of ways to feed. But anyway, a lot of the smaller birds, then that kind of seed, I would always go with chopped up sunflower seeds. And they're just the meats, not the black shells, but they've been cut. So because they're chopped in half, they aren't going to grow. So even if the birds got messy, and something fell to the ground, it wouldn't grow. The other thing is that if you have a mix of seeds, one of those songbird seed mixes that you can buy, it's a mix of seeds, and each bird species is going to have a preferred seed out of that mix, and they will pick out the good stuff and throw the other stuff on the ground. So it gets really messy. And
So are
things
they
grow and get slimy and rot. Anyway, chopped sunflower seeds is the way to go.
so as a bird feeding person, you would suggest not buying those mixes or just
Never,
okay.
never, ever, ever.
All right, Lois, what do you buy?
Chopped sunflower seeds.
Okay, got it.
I go to the place where you get chicken feed and I say, give me a 20-pound bag of medium chip.
There you
And
go.
that's what it is.
Your
And we have a lot of farmers in the area, so you can certainly go to an ag store and buy, or you can do it online. Anyway,
I
chop
will
some.
mention that one bit of damage that we have had from scrub jays on our property over the years, they do significant predation on our pecan crop, and they are a huge problem anywhere that pecans are grown. It may not be scrub jay, could be the it obviously will be the blue jay that is native to that region. It took me forever to figure this out. I have 100 pecan trees, and my neighbor would finish harvesting the walnuts. And pecans don't come in until the walnuts are done. So he's shaking them all down. He's vacuuming them all up and picked everything up. And I'm watching my pecans developing and the hulls are splitting. And as soon as he picks them up, I start seeing the damage on the pecans that are still in the hulls, but the hulls have begun to split up on the tree. And this is October, typically. We're getting into late October at this point when the harvest crews are gone. So it's a challenge to get your pecans harvested locally. And I watch as every day, more pecans are just disappearing. And now you have to ask how they can do this. Well, I've watched. I sat there. I took a chair and sat there and watched one afternoon because they were driving me crazy. We were losing a higher and higher and higher percentage of our pecans, which should be a high value ag crop if it weren't for this problem. They get in there and they pick them out of the hull, which has split until they fall to the ground. Then they hop down there and they batter them with their beaks over and over and over again with a fairly thin shell of a pecan, they can break into it. Somewhere in that process, they're often scared off by me or my dog or something, in which case the nearby ground squirrels appreciate the work that they've done to make that pecan available. And in fact, I think personally, I think they collaborate on this. I'm pretty sure they have a communication system where the scrub jays come in, get their percentage, and share the rest with the ground squirrels. It can be anywhere from 10 to 50% crop loss. from scrub jays on your pecan tree. And in fact, in southern states where pecans are major crops, some pecan growers will intentionally just harvest early. They'll just shake the trees as soon as the hulls start to split, even though that's a hassle because they have to dry them more to get the hulls to split properly. They have to shake the trees harder, which is not so great for the trees. But because of the crop losses from scrub jays or blue jays or whatever it is in their region, they actually do this in order to conserve their crop. Because if you've ever tried to scare away birds from an agricultural crop, you know it's very, very challenging. I have saved as an MP3 file 2.5 hours of screeching hawks.
And you can listen to that for how many days?
Yeah, well, it's not great, but fortunately I'm out in the country. So I took this out and I put it out there on a little iPod with little speakers that I didn't care about. And I played it and all those scrub jays did move down to the end of the field. It did definitely work. It moved them about 300 feet away from where I was playing it. So all you need to do, fill your orchard up with things playing this MP3 file of screeching hawks and you can save your pecan crop.
Now, did you do this long enough to find out whether or not they become acclimated to the noise and go, well, it's not really a hawk. I don't know what it is, but it's not really a hawk.
No, because I couldn't acclimate to it. But it did
work. You'd never get that with mockingbirds because mockingbirds like to, well, learn other people's songs right. And play them. And they have been known to learn, you know, car alarms. Or in my case, when I was fighting forest fires, we had little pagers. And the mockingbird in my neighborhood heard that pager enough times, it started playing that song.
So just imagine mockingbirds going around screaming like hawks, and there you go.
Yeah, that wasn't good. That wasn't good. Yeah. And so in case you were wondering why the timing of that is, have you ever seen a crow get a walnut, fly out and drop it on the road to crack it?
Yeah.
So the corvids, the crows that chase the magpies, they like nuts. They enjoy nuts.
Right. Crows have been.
If the jay is able to get nuts from the walnuts, okay, well, then it doesn't have to go battering things on the pecans. So my guess is that it was eating walnuts before its food source went away.
Oh, we know it was. And what happens when they harvest walnuts? Walnut harvest is all mechanical. They shake the trees, they drive through, and they vacuum them up. And in the vacuuming process, they crunch a whole bunch of them. They basically leave a whole bunch of crushed walnuts on the ground, which the jays then have a field day with until they're gone. And then they realize there's this pecan orchard over on the next field. Crows were, before West Nile virus. And this is something most people really aren't aware of. Crows were a big problem on almonds in particular. They would come in great quantities. My neighbor would explain to me how he would lose 4 or 5% of his almond crop to crows while the almonds were still in the green stage back before they were anywhere close to harvest. He would watch them, and I'd seen this happen on my own trees when I had almonds. A group of 10, 15, 20 crows would land in a tree just screaming and shrieking as they used to do, knocking them out of the tree, knocking them to the ground, breaking them open while they're still soft and feeding on the soft kernel that's on the inside. And you would go out as a farmer and I would find broken almond hulls underneath a tree and not a single nut left on the tree. Typically, they would do this damage on the edge of the orchard. So, because there is nearby cover for them to move back and forth or whatever. So, it wouldn't go all the way into the orchard. It wasn't 100% crop loss. But if you're a farmer and crows are causing a 5% or more crop loss, you're going to start taking lethal measures or figuring out something. Good luck if you figure that out. What happened with West Nile virus, as you know, maybe listeners don't know this, corvids were decimated by it. West Nile virus spread across the United States 20 years ago, roughly, and got to California, and it affected the crows, magpies, and
jays.
And the jays.
The jays, not so much, but the crows a lot. The magpies, we have yellow-billed magpies, which are basically unique to our area, and just wiped out so many. And those birds are... they are congregate nesters. That is to say, they like to go and build lots of nests near each other. And so there'd be a rookery here, and then there'd be a rookery over and there, and then rookery in the next place. Well, when West Nile virus killed 20%, 30%, 80%, I don't know how many. It
Remember
depends.
those numbers? Yeah.
Huge numbers. So what would happen is there would not be enough magpies left. The survivors would not be a large enough group to feel comfortable building nests. And so they had to go and collect up with other survivors. And so you may have had six rookeries in the area and end up with only one after West Nile wiped out so many.
Right
And
before.
now as those rookeries get big enough, if they get too big, they'll split into two groups. Some of them will go off and start another rookery. Might be the same trees that they used to go to, might be different ones.
Yeah, routinely there were two of them on our property because we have the biggest trees in the area. Now they make these big, messy nests up in the tree that are just branches piled on each other, is what they appeared to be. Any north wind would bring part of the nest down and they would be screaming for the rest of the day. I used to joke that it was like having a bunch of drunken parrots living with you because they really were that noisy and that aggressive and that, there are many of them. There would be 15 or 20 of them between these two rookeries as you're describing it. When the West Nile virus hit, it decimated them. My recollection is the numbers were 80 to 90% population loss in the Sacramento Valley, building back up finally to maybe 20% of what it used to be, enough that occasionally they'll start to settle in on our property and then get chased off by raptors, a phenomenon that is very common in larger trees. And someone said, "Well, what can we do?" And I said, "Well, really, the only thing you can do is help people plant big trees. Get more big trees going in places where they might, if the population rebounds, have a safe place to build those kinds of nests. There's nothing you can do in your backyard to encourage magpies to come back, but the bigger trees are what they need. This enormous walnut on my property, the giant sycamore, that's what they need. But also, their numbers are going to rebuild slowly, steadily, we hope. That's pretty much the best. So the corvids include, just to repeat,
Crows, ravens, magpies, jays.
okay. And they were all pretty badly hit to different levels by West Nile. Yeah.
And they're also some of the smarter birds in the world. Lots of
Oh,
smart birds.
yes. They can figure out how to get, they can figure out how to use traffic and people to crack those nuts open for them. So, anyway, there's
And
not a
if you can
whole
figure out how to use a twig to go in there in a hole and get what that worm too. No, seriously. If you want to see something interesting, go on YouTube and search for crow friends or something like that, or smart crows. And a lot of these are the European crow, but that's okay. And they'll show people who have put out something the crow would like to eat, and they put it in a jar, and the crow has to do this and this to get it into to get in out. Okay. And they go further and further, and the crows are really having a fun with this game. I mean, it's like it's one peanut, who cares? But they're having fun with this game. So it's interesting.
Birds you can draw into your garden. You'll be living in a place that's appropriate for them or not. Although we did mention the mockingbirds and the jays. The one thing I know that I brought them in by planting food sources, by berries that I didn't care that much about. There's also always areas with some water. I do think you mentioned that at the start, and that seems to be really important. That somewhere in there, the bird bath is simple. If I've got a little leak in the drip system and it's putting more water in a puddle area, I don't rush to fix that because I know all kinds of wildlife take advantage of it. You can actually make things like that. They're just very shallow basins that will collect water from a drip system, maybe a half inch of water at a time, enough that it'll evaporate out before mosquitoes would build up, but provide some water for a day or two after you've irrigated. There's lots of ways to do this without violating the drought restrictions. Having some water that is something that they can simply visit as they're passing through, enjoying your mulberries, feasting on the leaf-footed bugs, and taking a quick bath before they move on to go crack your pecans.
And for other birds, just if people want to encourage birds, the best thing, the most important thing you can do is stop spraying poisons in your yard. I mean, that's the biggest thing.
Well,
And then
I would
after
say,
that,
let me address that. Most people don't anymore. We don't have,
good.
at least in my experience, having been a retailer now for 4 decades, is that the standard practice of going out and spraying a bunch of stuff with pesticide because of bugs, unidentified bugs. Conversation I had not long after we opened in the 1980s. "Hey, Don, is it time for me to start my weekly sprays of malathion?" And I said, this is a very highly educated person. I have great, I still know him to this day. And I said, well, what are you spraying for? You know, let's talk about what the problem is. Cause I was trained in integrated pest management. Step one, identify the pest. He just shrugged and he goes, you know, bugs, just don't want any bugs in the yard. So that's the start of a long conversation, but people don't do that the way they used to. And I'm glad to see that. They come in with a pest problem, at least in my store. And we focus on, why are you having this particular problem? Is there some change in the environment that we can make? Is it really a big problem? Are you okay with knowing this has a 2 to 4 week life cycle and the plant will outgrow it just fine and everything will be okay? Most people are. Most people nowadays don't really want to just automatically use pesticides. But I would say the other thing is to let things get a little more overgrown. Yeah. Because having clipped, manicured, shrubs that never have a chance to develop any density or any hiding places or any nesting spaces. We found the very first place that hummingbirds nested on our property was in our great big clump of bamboo that we had planted a couple of years prior. It's dense, it's twiggy, they can go way inside there and feel safe. I didn't plant this clumping bamboo to draw hummingbirds. It was a nice bonus of having done that. But I will often tell you, if you're having a problem with roof rats, to prune things away from each other, prune them away from the fence, make things a little less overgrown. For birds and a lot of other wildlife, it's important to have a less rigid landscape. I guess that's the way I would put it. Constant clipping and pruning and spraying is just not a good habitat for them.
And if you do enjoy birds, then having different kinds of levels of height. So in other words, I have a great big xylosma bush, and then next to that, there's a lilac bush, which is, you know, half as big. And then if you can make it so that they have the ability to go from one bush to the next bush, to some tree, to something else, they are more comfortable following those, you know, little twig to little twig, hidden from the sky. We do have hawks here. And in residential areas, there are Cooper's hawks. They're forest hawks. They have thinner wings and shorter tails, so they can maneuver really well in the trees. And hey, they're hunters. They eat birds. They eat mice. They eat, you know, they're hunters.
Marsh hawks and harriers do the same thing, and they come into my yard all the time. They have not concerned about me in the least.
You're in the country. You've got lots of open space around you. In a residential area, it's usually, you know, there's fences and there's trees and there's stuff, and so they're not as active. Though the little that hide in the bushes as they move from place to place, they survive better than the other ones. And so that behavior is carried forward.
Now, of course, we're having this conversation in the summer. In the winter, you're just encouraging white-crowned sparrows and it's pointless.
Well, Don, as I've told you before, the white-crowned sparrows are particularly nervous birds. They do not want to get more than a few feet away from something. In my backyard, my back patio concrete, I could put out some seeds. They like to eat on the ground. Okay, I could put out some seeds for them. Nothing happened. Why didn't it? Well, it turns out that it was like 15 to 20 feet to the xylosma bushes in the back. And it was just lawn in between. There was no place, hiding place. So I would go out and in the fall, I'd go out, and when people were pruning their prunings and put it in the street, I'd bring home a few piles of little branches and twigs and stuff. And I'd build myself a little twig pile out there halfway between where I wanted to feed them so I could see them and the bush where they felt safe. So I put this thing, and it's like 3 feet tall with branches and twigs. Oh, perfect. They can come from the bush, hop in there, and then hop out to eat. It's right, you know, only a few inches away, and they can get right back. So they can be safe from cats and hawks and stuff.
So to prevent white-crowned sparrows from feeding in your vegetable garden, you should make a blind, is what you're describing, on the other side of the yard, and put the bird food for the white-crowned sparrows on the other side of the yard, and they'll stay over there, right?
Almost. You'll plant, if you plant your garden 20 feet away from any bush, they will be very hesitant to get out in the open like that.
Okay. No promises, your results, May vary. That's your bird segment at the Davis Garden Show.
With bird expert Lois Richter, who isn't really a bird expert.
Close enough.
Leanne writes, the reason I am emailing is I am hoping you have some insight on dealing with some established perennial weeds that are at a half dozen of the school gardens I care for. I actually enjoy most types of weeding, but I have been frustrated with the amount of bindweed and nutsedge.
Oh, yeah.
I would like to use my time eradicating these weeds in the most efficient way possible. At work, I am limited to using only organic methods, and the gardens are in constant use from late September to late July. Before I joined the team, the vegetable gardens were built by scraping up the top of the turf. The layer of woven landscape fabric and then a layer of non-woven fabric was laid down, and then it was topped with wood chip mulch. I was told the school district allowed sedgehammer herbicide to be applied at one school, but my understanding is it is more effective on yellow nutsedge and timing is critical. Regardless, that site still has nutsedge. The purple nutsedge continues to come through the landscape fabric and mulch and up into the veggie beds, and every week I pull out the new shoots. So let's talk about that. And she's got another question about...
Yeah, nutsedge is probably one of the most difficult weeds in the world to eradicate. It's interesting that the school district was allowing the use of a particular herbicide. That tells you that they realize how difficult nutsedge is to eradicate. And there are two different types, and it is correct that sedgehammer only works on one of the two different types of nutsedge. I remember I would always talk to people about using landscape fabric as one option for nutsedge. And I've done so. I remember reading some detailed studies, greenhouse studies, on different geotextiles, is the term we use for landscape fabrics, and how effective they were. And certain weeds in woven fabrics can push through the holes in the weave. Most weeds are smothered by them, and landscape fabrics can be effective. I know they're controversial, but they can be effective for hard-to-kill perennial weeds in certain situations. And boy, if there's a hard-to-kill perennial weed, nutsedge is probably the number one. The geotextiles showed really good efficacy or effectiveness on all kinds of other weeds, except nutsedge. It was not nearly as good because they could push through, and then you had a real mess on your hands. But it still reduced them, even these greenhouse studies, by 90%. You know, that's nothing to sneeze at. That's pretty good. I can see, though, that the district probably got so fed up with the problem of the woven landscape fabric that then they put a layer of non-woven fabric on top. What's wrong with that? Well, water doesn't penetrate. Air exchange doesn't occur. So at least where that fabric is, this is not good for the soil. It's the soil mycorrhizae can't live, and a lot of roots can't do really well in that situation. And on the flip side of that is the roots that can do well in that situation stay right under the landscape fabric. They don't go down into the soil. So if you ever do pull that back and there's any trees or shrubs nearby, you've suddenly exposed a lot of their roots, and you should be aware of that. At least mulch again really quickly before you do anything more. I'll just tell you one little factoid about nutsedge that'll at least make you feel like you're not completely wasting your time. If you pull it or dig it when it's at the 2 to 6 leaf stage, you actually have killed that plant and not left anything behind. Okay. So when it first comes up, if you want to focus your efforts, when it first comes up, digging, pulling, uprooting, grubbing it out, when it's 2 to 4, up to 6 leaves, it hasn't yet formed nutlets. So if you're really diligent then, and that our area, that's sometime in the spring, then you can keep it under control. I'll never promise anything is going to eradicate nutsedge, but focus your efforts in particular when it first comes up. Because if you pull up a plant in July, the plant you pulled up leaves behind 5, 10, 15 nutlets, each of which sprout. So it's a great math lesson for the kids, but not very useful in terms of weed abatement. You pull up a plant that's got all these nutlets behind, all the nutlets sprout. So it seems like you've gone from one to, my goodness, now there's 10 of them here. So it's much more effective to pull the nutsedge early in the season, then smother it again with whatever you're using. And I always prefer to see woven geotextiles to unwoven ones, because at least they allow water to penetrate. And then the bark over that makes a great path. And then anything that pushes through all of that, someone should be really diligent about hand pulling if you possibly can, or just dump something more on it. So we do get back to one really basic principle, which is that no plant virtually can live without photosynthesis, and they can't photosynthesize if their leaves are buried. So if you got a big old pile of arborist wood chips that's nearby that you accomplished by registering at chipdrop.com or contacting the tree service, the school district probably has a tree service, or probably a contracts with the city for their tree work, in which case the city folks might be willing to bring their ground up trees, give you a 15, 20 cubic yard pile of that stuff. That sounds like a great kids project one day, is moving all that stuff around. Keep a couple yards of it in reserve so that when any little bit of nutsedge pops up, another couple inches go right on top of those plants. I mean, you can get, there's got to be some kid in that school who will monitor this for you and who sees it and has his own little shovel, her own little shovel. They can go over there and they can take a couple scoops and bury it again. So they understand that weed needs to be buried so it can't photosynthesize. Those are the non-chemical approaches to nutsedge.
So I want to describe the actual nutsedge itself and how it works. If I understand correctly, I had these nutsedges in my yard, and then they put down various cloths and bark and all this stuff. Now the nutsedge has poked through a hole and has grown up. Now it coming from a nut, right? There's a little bulb underneath, and one bulb is sending up a shoot. Now, when it gets up into the air, it's got a fairly long stem from that bulb underground to the greenery at the top. Does it use up the bulb that's there, or does that bulb sprout again the next year? If it's normal cycle, we're not messing with it. And then the second question is, are the new bulblets formed down off the original bulb, or are they coming up the sides of that stem that's in the dark?
Neither in the case of the second question. The first question is, you do need to pull the bulb. If you just break it off, there's enough energy stored for it to sprout again. So a tool like a dandelion digger is very handy for this. These are sharp, so perhaps they should be supervised in the use of these tools. I'm going to assume a grown-up does this part, but you just push it down. Soil should be wet. This is really important for any weeding. The soil should be moistened as you do it or beforehand. I usually have a hose running at a trickle while I'm weeding, and it's sitting on the next weed I'm going to pull while I'm pulling the one that it was trickling on just a moment before, because I get the soil to be a slurry before I pull a weed out. Now, this has reduced my back injuries considerably. If it's a taprooted plant, I just set the hose there, and someone watching me do this, I think it was my son, said, "Wow, that's absolutely brilliant. You should tell people about this." I thought, people don't know about this idea. So he just set a hose there. He didn't, apparently. Set a hose there and really let it soak until the soil is so wet that it's literally soupy. And most things will pull right out. Even taprooted plants will pull out surprisingly easy. It's a muddy mess. So this is something you do when you don't mind getting muddy and messy, but it works really well. But to your first question, the bulb itself needs to be pulled out with the plant. And if you get it early enough, 2 to 4, maybe 6 leaf stage, it hasn't yet formed the new bulbs, which regrettably form further out on the root. So you can pull that thing up 4 weeks later and you're leaving those roots behind, and the bulbs have started to form on the roots, and now you have several of them. There's lots of bulb forming plants that do this, sometimes to our advantage, like Tulip clusiana, Tulip chrysantha. These are wonderful. Let's change the subject completely for a moment to something positive. These are wonderful flowering bulbs from Mediterranean region. Actually, they're from Turkey. And each one produces new bulbs several inches out on the root. So your main plant now has a new baby plant 3, 4, 5 inches away, and then another one 3, 4, 5 inches away. I'm aware of stands of these tulips in Davis. One of them's in a sidewalk strip where it's just a solid carpet of this particular tulip. I am aware of one customer who thinks they're annoying, which I thought, I can certainly think of worse problems. Imagine if it were nutsedge, for example. It's the same principle. These little bulbs form further out on the root. So when you pull the plant, they're all left behind, and they'll all sprout at that point, more widely separated. So now you went from one plant to a little group of 8 or 10. And so each of them would need to be dug out. So you try to get as early as you can. Train people to recognize the folded, pointed leaves of the first shoots of nutsedge, and know, okay, now it's a priority, because we've talked before about integrated pest management. This is integrated vegetation management. What's the timing of your strategy that's going to be the most effective? And if you're going to use manual or mechanical control, as we call it, with nuts edge, it's right as it comes up. You remember where it was last year. You flag that if you have to somehow. You monitor that. And then you go as a group of people and you go out there and you dig them out, bulbs and all, if you possibly can, when they're at that 2 to 4, maximum 6 leaf stage. And you can get surprisingly good control over a period of time. So that, I think, was both of your questions with respect to how what its life cycle is.
Yeah.
I'll tell you how I got rid of it. There was a patch of it on our property. And what I did was I gave up trying to plant flowery things in there, and I gave up trying to plant low growing plants in there. And I just planted a big woody plant that shades everything out. I believe in that instance, I used rosemary, one of the bigger, like Irene rosemary, which spreads, but it gets 18 inches tall. And there was a lot of nuts edge for the first couple of years while it was getting established, but the rosemary kept growing taller and further out, taller and further out. And eventually it was solid enough that it shaded it all out, and there was no more nut sedge. So many of these woody plants, if you can make this work, Artemisia Powis Castle, forgive me for recommending that if you're familiar with it for taking over your yard, but it's a very vigorous spreader, gets dense, nothing grows through it. Some of our native salvia, Salvia clevelandii, Pozo blue, Salvia sonamensis, rosemary, the one called Irene, not the prostrate one that's only 6 to 8 inches. You need higher than that. Got to be higher than the nut sedge. So Irene, which gets about 1 to 1.5 feet, but spreads outward and eventually gets enough density that nothing will grow through it. These are plants that will simply shade it out. So you're out competing it with a plant that's woody that will be there forever. I have little doubt that if I dug out that rosemary and watered that area 18, 20 years later, nut sedge would probably pop right back up. It's not there for now, so I've got it under control. That's good enough for me.
So nut sedge is that thing that looks sort of like coarse grass, isn't it?
It looks like grass, but the leaves are folded.
And does it ever have a flower?
Yes.
Or is it all mulch?
It's a papyrus, and the flower looks like a papyrus. Ooh. It's the same genus as papyrus. In fact,
so why not just enjoy it?
You should make... I had someone ask me that question about oxalis one time, and my answer was that should be a conscious decision.
Yeah.
Right. Don't just do it passively, because once you've made the decision, you're going to let it increase. You're just making it harder and harder if you ever want to get rid of it. This person's question was, well, oxalis is all over my lawn. How about if I just make it my lawn? Fine, if you're okay with that. But bear in mind that every year it's making more seed, more seed, more seed. Also, in the case of oxalis, can shoot its seed 6 feet. So if it's near your neighbors, that's not a very polite thing to do. You're right, though. The nut sedge stays there, you know, just increases locally, primarily. That's its main issue. And the main thing is you're just making it harder to get rid of it in the long run. And once it gets under the edge of the bed and gets up into the vegetable garden border, it can be a real challenge when you're trying to grow flowers and vegetables and things like that.
Okay, one last question on nut sedge. And this is a lazy person's solution.
Yep.
So if someone goes, oh, there's a nut sedge, and you take the top and you pull it up and it's gone. Now there's still a nutlet down below. Is that nutlet, and we did this in February, is that nutlet going to sprout again this year, or is it going to wait until next year?
Both, either could happen. Both of those things could happen.
So how many times can that nutlet have its top ripped off before it gives up and dies?
Seemingly, I won't say it's an infinite number, but it's seemingly a large number. It's a remarkable plant for its duration. So I wouldn't count on that as a method. But again, with some of these plants, and we'll get on to bindweed in a minute, accepting them, managing them is going to be a much better goal than eradicating them. And so, you know, how to not make this worse and how to make your garden acceptable and it's okay if they're over there kind of thing is probably what you're going to come up with, which brings us to the next paragraph of Leanne's letter.
And she said, my other weed challenge, bindweed, is only at one school site, does not have a landscape fabric barrier, and the soil is heavy clay. We have covered as much of the non-growing space with cardboard and mulch to limit where the bindweed grows. It creeps out at the edges and I pull it out. Due to the sticky nature of the soil, the bindweed easily snaps off as I tried to weed it out of the vegetable beds, which are not covered with a cardboard. Are these weeds accidentally spread around to other school sites on shoes or shovels? How careful should I be after weeding places that have nutsedge and bindweed? Do you have any suggestions or encouragement for dealing with these weeds? Thank you.
Bindweed is one of the major plants on my farm, and if it's an open field area where I'm not presently worried about growing any vegetables or anything, I don't worry too much about it, but I do have a rule that I try not to let it go much past flowering because the seed of convolvulus or bindweed, which is in the morning glory family, the seed can be quite prolific and also can apparently last in the soil for as much as 20 years or more. So if I were to let it go completely, it's we're doing this program in June, July, and it's in full bloom right now. So that's my reminder to get out there and do something about it. If it's just mowing it off so it doesn't set seed, pulling it up so that it doesn't set seed, pulling it so it doesn't climb up into the rose bushes nearby, that kind of thing. The seed is large. This is not like spurge seed or oxalis where it's going to be sticking to shoes or moving on equipment. I don't think that seed is a common method of dispersal of either nutsedge or bindweed from one school site to another, although it is always wise to check your pant legs and your socks for weed seeds, because we do disseminate weed seeds. I'd be far more concerned about cleavers or Velcro plant, that one that people have so much trouble with, or some of the thistles or things like that, which do stick to you. I don't think that's a major concern with either of these. So that's the good news. Bindweed roots, and again, it's a morning glory. It's a very pretty flower. I mean, a lot of people look at it and go, maybe they should just breed this. They should just come up with some garden versions of it with brighter colored flowers, because it's mostly white, sometimes light pink. What if they had a bright red one? Would you then be so mad about it? So there's a thought, we could just turn it into a garden plant. It's very deep rooted, 2 to 4 feet deep is what I'm told. It has an amazing capacity, to go down below the grasses and mustards in the winter and just wait for you to come along and get your letter from the fire marshal or whatever and get your field all mowed to get all that stuff up there that's flammable, get that out of the way, and up it pops because it comes out of the ground when the soil temperature is about the same time as when we're planting, say, peppers. So April, May, sometimes as early as late March, is when morning glory or bindweed starts coming up. And it does spread very rapidly across the ground. What makes it such a difficult garden weed is that it's a vine. And it climbs very rapidly and twines itself very tight around whatever it's growing on. It's not the kind of thing, it's not like arching up into it. It is binding itself, hence the name bindweed, up onto whatever is nearby. And if it's a rose bush or a tomato plant, it'll very quickly go to the top. It'll very quickly grow over the entire top and completely shade out the plant below, ultimately killing it, or in the case of your summer vegetables, significantly reducing yield. So for most people, but first of all, chemicals work okay on it. I mean, common garden herbicides work okay, but not that well. It is deep rooted. It does detach readily, as you found when you try and pull it. You never get the whole root system. So I've learned long ago to just kind of let it migrate out to where it doesn't bother me and either hoe it, chop it, mow it, pull it, whatever it takes to keep it from going to seed and from reestablishing itself where I don't want it. And she's right, it does spread under landscape fabric. You can cover it with landscape fabric here and all along the edges, it's going to come up. Well, you just keep pulling it there, or you just keep adding more landscape fabric or whatever you do. If you bury it with arborist wood chips, I guarantee even if you put 6 inches down, it's going to push right through it. So at that point, it's a combination of mulching, smothering, and chopping. And that does work up to a point. You go ahead and you pull it all out of the area. You cover it with the arborist wood chips. 4 to 6 inches deep is fine. Landscape fabric, okay, if you want to do that, but isn't really going to make much difference in this case because it can push right through landscape fabric. And after 3 or 4 weeks, you'll find it's coming up through even several inches of arborist wood chips. But if you keep breaking that off, that part of the plant will stop growing. Rhizome is down there, moving further out, further out, further out. So in one yard where I had a lot of it, we got it out of our yard completely. We pulled it every time we saw it. We mulched, we pulled, we cut, we chopped, we did everything. And at one point it was completely gone. And I got up on the fence and peered over in my neighbor's yard, and it was all along the fence line on their side. So it had gone steadily, no problem, under the fence into their yard where they weren't doing anything about it. And I have little doubt that they probably would have come right back in if we hadn't kept after it. It's a weed you can manage. It's very difficult to eradicate. The common herbicides, things like glyphosate, do kill it. So if that's something you're allowed to use or comfortable with using, it will do the job up to a point, but it'll only kill a part of it. It's not going to kill the whole stand. And so I think that cutting, don't let it go to seed. Pull it before the you know, when you see it blooming, is really important to get out there to keep the problem from getting worse. And continuing to smother it where you don't want it is going to be your most effective thing in the long run. For that one, I had another area on my property where I had it coming up pretty regularly. And I also happened to plant rosemary there because I really like rosemary. And it took a lot longer to shade out the bindweed than it had taken to shade out the nut sedge. 5 years later, I have a whole bed of Irene and Collingwood Ingrami rosemary. And for the first time, there's no morning glory, no bindweed coming up through that rosemary. 5 years is what it took to do that. And what I had to do while it was getting going was, as soon as it came up onto the rosemary, put on some gloves, just go out there and pull it off. Just pull it off, break it off, pull it off, break it off. And eventually that did shade it out to the point the only place it's left is out on the county road nearby. And that part, someone else is going to deal with. So you can shade it out. It'll just migrate to wherever it can come up. It's a more challenging one in some ways because those rhizomes are amazingly long-lived down there and can continue to grow until they can find a place to reestablish.
So if you had a bindweed plant growing up through, rose or something, and suddenly you see a bindweed flower up there. Now, if I went down to the base to that rose and I cut the stem so the flower part was dissociated from the other part, is there anything in that part that's climbed up the rose that I have to worry about, or will it just die?
No, and I can tell you from considerable experience, that's the one of the simplest things you can do, because I have a whole lot of roses and this is a very common situation where it comes up near the rose before you even notice what's happened. It's already getting up there. It's already gotten up to the top. I make absolutely sure if I'm walking by and I see that, I don't wait till later. I don't put this on a must get this done in the next few weeks kind of list. This is stoop down right now and break it off. Just break it. Break that connection to the soil. That part of the bindweed that's up on the rose will die, and that's that. That's taken care of. If you want to pull it out, that's fine, but it's kind of uncomfortable and awkward to do because of the thorns of the roses. But at least you've stopped the process of it going completely over the plant, and it will go from coming up to the top of your rose bush in a matter of just 3 or 4 weeks. So you do need to keep after it. So as with all weeding, it's easier to do little bits over a period of time than to try and then keep saying, I'll take care of all this later. You know, later is August. And by then they're everywhere and they've reseeded and you've made more of a problem for yourself. So with the nut sedge, get it early on if you possibly can. With the bindweed, at least break it off. Don't let it go to seed and keep after it. Keep breaking it off until it's moved, migrated to a part of the yard where you don't care about it. You've been listening to the Davis Garden Show with Don Shore
and Lois Richter here at KDRT-LP 95.7 in Davis, California.
KDRT-FM is a community radio station broadcasting at 95.7 on the FM dial and worldwide at kdrt.org. Community radio relies entirely on contributions from listeners like you and me to support our operating costs. If you want to donate, go to kdrt.org, kdrt.org, and look for the support button. Thanks for your contributions, and thanks for listening to KDRT.